A reading from the book of Genesis. When Isaac was old and his eyes were dim so that he could not see, he called his elder son Esau and said to him, "My son." And Esau answered, "Here I am." He said, "See, I'm old. I do not know the day of my death. Now then, take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, and go out to the field and hunt game for me. Then prepare for me savory food, such as I like, and bring it to me to eat, so that I may bless you before I die." So Jacob went in to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Jacob said to his father, "I am Esau, your firstborn. I've done as you told me. Now sit up and eat my game, so that you may bless me." But Isaac said to his son, "How is it that you have found it so quickly, my son?" He answered, "Because the Lord your God granted me success." Then Isaac said to Jacob, "Come near that I may feel you, my son, to know whether you are really my son Esau or not." So Jacob went up to his father Isaac, who felt him and said, "The voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau." He did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands. So he blessed him. Jacob left Beersheba and went towards Haran. He came to a certain place and stayed there for the night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place. And he dreamed that there was a ladder set up on the earth, the top of it reaching to heaven, and the angels of Yahweh were ascending and descending on it. And Yahweh stood beside him and said, "I am the Lord, the Yahweh of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and to your offspring, and your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and all the families of the earth shall be blessed in you and your offspring. Know that I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you." Then Jacob woke up from his sleep and said, "Surely Yahweh is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid and said, "How awesome is this place! There is none other than the house of Yahweh, and this is the gate of heaven." So Jacob rose early in the morning, and he took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called that place Bethel, and the name of the city was Luz at the first. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, "If Yahweh will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then Yahweh shall be my God, and this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be Yahweh's house, and of all that you give me, I will surely give one-tenth to you." Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to John. The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you get to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man."
We are now back to using the narrative lectionary that walks us through the story of the nation of Israel before jumping into the life of Jesus around about Christmas time. Last week, we explored Abraham's offer of his beloved son Isaac as a sacrifice, and how just at the last minute, God interrupted him and provided a ram instead, letting Abraham and then the later Israelite people know that human and child sacrifice was not something that their God wanted, even though it was practiced in the religion of the surrounding neighbors. This week, we move on to that son Isaac when he is much older and aware of his mortality. He has two sons, and it is customary at that time to bestow a blessing on the elder son that would secure his place as the next patriarch of the household and ensure that he inherited a double portion of the estate with the authority and responsibility to take over after his father. So the blessing would recognize him as what we might call the heir apparent. Our reading started with Isaac calling his elder son Esau to him and asking that he go out hunting and prepare the animal he takes with all the fixings of a meal, just as Isaac liked it. And then after eating this celebratory meal, Isaac would bless him with the blessing of the firstborn. So Isaac heads out, Esau heads out hunting. Don't laugh at me. And we didn't read all the details in between, but Rebekah, Isaac's wife, overhears his request of Esau. And she sees an opportunity to pull a fast one and ensure that her favorite son, Jacob, the younger one, can slip in and get the blessing of the firstborn from the father. She prepares a meal from the flock, just like Isaac likes it. And she dresses Jacob in Esau's clothes and covers his arms with the goat skin to make them hairy like Esau's. And then our reading started with Jacob takes the food into his father, claiming to be his older brother Esau. Now Isaac has his doubts. He hears the voice of Jacob, but he gets him to come close and he smells the open hunting grounds on the clothes of Esau. And he feels the hairy goat skins that Jacob's put on and goes, oh yeah, this must be Esau. So he eats the meal and then he pronounces the blessing over Jacob. It might help for us to think of this blessing like what we would call a last will and testament of Isaac. The ancient people believed in the ability of the spoken word to accomplish what it said. So the blessing, even though it's spoken, was seen as determinative as our written, signed, and witnessed contracts. Once it's done, it's over. It is a done deal. Signed, sealed, delivered, and you cannot take it back. Now, not surprisingly, when Esau finds out what his younger brother did, he's furious and swears he's going to kill him once their father has passed on. Then Rebekah figures this might be a good time to request that her husband send Jacob back to her family in Mesopotamia to find a wife among their relatives instead of marrying a woman from the nearby people who practice a different religion. And Isaac agrees, and he calls Jacob in and tells him to go back to his mother's homeland and find a wife. Now the journey would be done on foot, and it would take weeks. And the last part of our reading was about what happened one night when Jacob was sleeping in the open and has a dream. Dreams are our way of processing in our minds the events that happen to us during our waking times. And I expect Jacob had been ruminating on his walk about being alone and far from everything that was familiar, and heading to a land he's never been to meet relatives he doesn't know. But then dreams are also recognized as a way the world of the spirits communicates with us. It's like when our conscious mind gets out of the way, when it's taking its rest, we're not distracted, and we can hear the quiet voices speaking to us that normally we're just oblivious to. So Jacob dreams of a ladder. The Hebrew word that is translated ladder here also means a stairway or a ramp. Essentially, it's something used to move between levels. So this transit way that he sees in his dream runs from heaven, from earth up into the heavens. And Jacob sees messengers of God going up and down on this route. And then he sees God standing there as well. And God speaks to him in this dream, introducing himself as the God of his grandfather Abraham and of his father Isaac. God then goes on to promise Jacob and his descendants the land that he is lying on, and that those descendants would be most numerous. And remember, Jacob isn't married yet. He still needs a mother for those children. But God continues with the promise he made to Abraham, saying that through Jacob, all the families of the earth will be blessed. This is another way of saying that all the people of the earth will have reason to thank Jacob and Jacob's descendants for the goodness that the people will receive. So Jacob receives the same promise from God that Abraham had two generations before. And then that same promise had been repeated to Isaac. But this time God adds something new. God reassures Jacob, saying, "Know that I am with you and will guard you wherever you go and not leave you." So we can read here, "Even when you leave this land like you are about to do and go live somewhere else." Then God adds that he will bring Jacob back again to his father's house in peace. Jacob wakes up astonished and overawed. He did not expect to hear from God. He did not expect to see God's agents going up and down between earth and heaven, going about their duties. And he says, "God is in this place, and I didn't even know it." He calls it the gate to the heavens, to the other realm where God dwells. Then in the morning, Jacob makes a decision about what he has been promised. We read that he says, "If God will do this and that," but it could also be read as, "Given that God will do this," or "Since God has promised to do this." So Jacob essentially says, "Since God has said he will be with me, will keep me safe as I travel, give me food to eat and clothes to wear, and bring me back home safely, then I'm in. I will take this God as my God, and I will give him a tenth of everything that comes my way." Giving a tenth, or tithing is the other word for it, was the standard way of acknowledging that everything belonged to whoever it is you're giving the tenth to. And in return for such an acknowledgement, that person would give you permission to use the 90% however it is that you want to use it. Now, Jacob's words sound rather contractual to our ears. "If God does that, then I will do this in response," is kind of what he's saying. But when you look more closely, you notice that the initiative lies with God. God comes to Jacob. Jacob did not pray for any help. God just shows up and promises to remain with Jacob, see him safely on his journey, and bring him back home again. God says Jacob will have numerous offsprings that will be bringers of blessing to everyone. And this is what's surprising. God makes no demands of Jacob in return. He doesn't say, well, Jacob, if you do this or that, if you, you know, shape up and fly right, if you worship me and you sacrifice to me and you do what I say, then I will do all of this for you. He doesn't say that. He just comes out and says, I'm going to bless you. I'm going to bring you back home. I'm going to keep you safe. And through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. And remember the belief of the people at that time that the spoken word had the ability to bring about what was said. So what God is saying is as good as done. That God would be with him and keep him safe and bring him home. That promise was just as good as it having been accomplished. And this is all independent of what Jacob thought or said or did or how he responded. This is a demonstration of God's grace. Grace is translated as unmerited favor. The Oxford Dictionary uses phrases like unconstrained goodwill, or a privilege that cannot be claimed as a right. God's grace involves his overflowing love for creation and humanity. Grace originates in God and flows from God's character and faithfulness. It has nothing to do with the worthiness or the goodness of the recipient. And in fact, God's grace is more fully shown when it is extended to someone we would consider especially unworthy. Consider Jacob. His name means heel grabber. He was born holding his brother's heel, like he's trying to hold him back from getting out of the womb first, and therefore being firstborn. We spoke sometime last year, I think, on the passage that has Jacob scamming Esau out of his birthright by lying in wait for him with some vegetable soup when he knew his brother would be coming back home after a long and unsuccessful hunt. And then in our reading today, Jacob easily goes along with his mother's plan to trick his father and steal his brother's inheritance. And he doesn't seem to be bothered about the deceit itself. He's more worried about possible bad consequences if it is found out. He goes into his father and lies to his face twice, saying, I am Esau, your firstborn. He is dressed in his brother's clothing to smell like him. He has fake hair on his body using goat skin, so he's hairy like his brother. And he even claims that God helped him on the hunt to find game quickly and easily. And then he stood there and watched his father eat that meal. I wonder what was going through his mind. Did he even have a little tickle of conscience wanting to back out of the whole thing and just, yeah, no, sorry, made a mistake, and quietly exit the tent? But he goes through with it and he gets the blessing. And then not long afterwards, God appears to him in a dream and makes extravagant promises of blessing. And God doesn't even mention Jacob's past. And I'm sure those two incidents were not the only ones in his life up to that point. I think he was 40 years old at this point. God just lets it slide by like it never, ever happened. And that, my friends, displays the character of the one we worship. God does not hold grudges. God does not remember wrongs. He doesn't hold them over us. He's patient and kind and always giving, not needing anything in return to maintain his acceptance of us. Jacob and we are not entitled to God's favor and goodness. We certainly do not earn it. Anybody here perfect? Yeah? No? No takers? And we don't have to be perfect to keep God's favor. Because we do nothing to receive God's goodness towards us, we can't do anything that would take that goodness away either. We can't remove ourselves as a recipient. We can't take ourselves out of the running and jeopardize it. And that's why some people don't like grace. It looks like allowing someone to get away with something wrong. In Paul's letter to the Romans, he describes God's abundant grace, and then he anticipates the question someone might ask. So should we go about sinning royally and grandly so God's grace can abound even more? And Paul's reply is, are you serious? Absolutely not. But extending grace to someone looks like leniency, like you are not taking doing the right thing seriously enough. But God doesn't seem to be bothered by that. It's his character to be generous and not miserly. The questions about God's grace don't come from God's side. He's not there going, is that person really worth my effort? Do I really see that, you know, they're going to do something good with what I do for them? Is it worth it? No. God just does it. We're the ones with the questions. We're the ones that have a problem with grace. We don't like to see it extended to others. Think of the elder son in that story of the prodigal son. I've been slaving away for you my whole life, and this dude scams you out of his money, goes running away, and loses it all, and comes back a beggar, and you throw a party for him? That older brother did not like his father being gracious. The other thing that happens with grace is it's human nature to insist that someone pay for wrongdoing. And sometimes we don't want to receive grace because we think of it as charity. We know we are undeserving, and we don't want it. We want to pay our own way, so to speak. Yeah, we screw up, but we should, you know, man up and take what comes our way. We shouldn't let somebody just forgive us and sweep it away. That wouldn't be right. And so we expect God to act that way too, but God doesn't. Jacob could have said he was unworthy, that he was a liar and a cheat, which is true, and that God had no business helping him out. He could have said, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. I made my bed, I will lie in it. It's my mess, let me live with it. But no, he is overawed by the generosity of God. And I think maybe that vision sort of helped him a little bit there. Not the type of thing you would forget anytime soon. But he does seem to respond to the promises like he's making a deal, like he's entering into a contract with God. Since God is promising this, then I will do that. And I think unspoken is, if God reneges on this, then I don't need to follow through. I'm off the hook. And we kind of do that too in our dealing with God. We think God demands something in return. Or more realistically, we make up something that we think God demands in return. That somehow we take it upon ourselves to pay God back and think that somehow that gets us in his good books. We're already in his good books. But if you read our text closely, in this encounter, God is not making any conditions on Jacob. The promises stand alone, and Jacob is free to respond however he wants. I wonder if he thinks, this is really too good to be true. But yeah, I'll go along. Count me in. Why wouldn't he? And I think he continued his journey with a much lighter heart than he had up to that point. These stories were edited and gathered together into the book we have today, not at the time of the events happening, but about 1,000 years later, during the time of the kings of a united nation of Israel, during David's time. And the people of that day would have been raised on stories about their ancestors. They would know Jacob as the father of the 12 patriarchs who started the 12 tribes of the nation. And maybe they squirmed a little bit, hearing him like he was. But the message for them was that this God who made these promises to the ancient patriarchs was the same God who brought them out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. This was the God who set them up as their own independent nation on a land that was especially suited for planting crops, pasturing flocks and herds, and growing orchards. They would also be reminded that their ancestors were not perfect, but that didn't stop God from working with them or for them. And it was relevant for the people of David's time too. They weren't perfect, but that wouldn't stop God from working with them and for them. God was generous and gracious, and that was something for them to celebrate. And it's the same for us today. We are not perfect. But God is the same today as he was with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, with King David and the people of his time, with Jesus, with us. Despite our wrongdoing, God still looks on us with favor and unconditional love. I encourage you to take today's lesson about Jacob and God's promises, despite Jacob's less than stellar character, as an illustration of how the same God approaches us. We do not earn God's goodness towards us. It flows from the character of God himself. There's a line in the Book of Common Prayer, in the prayer after communion, that I especially love. After thanking God for feeding us in Holy Communion, it goes on to say, assuring us thereby of thy favor and goodness towards us. That warms my heart that God and Jesus has given us this memorial meal to reenact that remembers an event that demonstrates God's deep love for us, his creatures. The sharing of the Eucharist is for us a concrete reminder of God's favor and grace. It's something we can see, we can touch, we can smell, we can taste. It's an action that we do and that we do together in community. And we know so much more about how God works and God's plan for creation than the patriarchs ever did. So let us respond to that deeper awareness with greater thanksgiving and praise for the God that we worship. Amen.